5, and I'll read the whole chapter to start with, and then go through it verse by verse. Psalm 35, a psalm of David. Plead my cause, O Lord, with those who strive with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of shield and buckler, and stand up for my help. Also, draw out the spear and stop those who pursue me. Say to my soul, I am your salvation. Let those be put to shame and brought to dishonor who seek my life. Let those be turned back and brought to confusion who plot my hurt. Let them be like chaff before the wind, and let the angel of the Lord chase them. Let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of the Lord pursue them. For without cause they have hidden their net for me in a pit, which they have dug without cause for my life. Let destruction come upon him unexpectedly, and let his net that he has hidden catch himself. Into that very destruction let him fall. And my soul shall be joyful in the Lord. It shall rejoice in his salvation. All my bones shall say, Lord, who is like you? Delivering the poor from him who is too strong for him. Yes, the poor and the needy from him who plunders him. Fierce witnesses rise up. They ask me things I do not know. They reward me evil for good, to the sorrow of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled myself with fasting, and my prayer would return to my own heart. I paced as though he were my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily as one who mourns for his mother. But in my adversity they rejoiced and gathered together. Attackers gathered against me, and I did not know it. They tore at me and did not cease. With ungodly mockers at feasts, they gnashed at me with their teeth. Lord, how long will you look on? Rescue me from their destructions, my precious life from the lions. I will give thanks in the great assembly. I will praise you among many people. Let them not rejoice over me who are wrongfully my enemies, nor let them wink with the eye who hate me without a cause. For they do not speak peace, but they devise deceitful matters against the quiet ones in the land. They also opened their mouth wide against me and said, aha, aha, our eyes have seen it. This you have seen, O Lord, do not keep silent. O Lord, do not be far from me. Stir up yourself and awake to my vindication. To my cause, my God and my Lord, vindicate me, O Lord my God, according to your righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. Let them not say in their hearts, ah, so we would have it. Let them not say we have swallowed him up. Let them be ashamed and brought to mutual confusion, to rejoice at my hurt. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor, who exalt themselves against me. Let them shout for joy and be glad, who favor my righteous cause. And let them say continually, let the Lord be magnified, who has pleasure in the prosperity of his servant. And my tongue shall speak of your righteousness and your praise all the day long. Well, this psalm talks about praying against enemies. And you might say, Jesus says, love your enemies. pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you. And that is true. And so, is this passage wrong? Some people would say, yeah, this is the Old Testament. Jesus is in the New Testament, and it cancels out the Old Testament. And I would say, no, the passage isn't wrong. You are wrong. You haven't put the things together. You haven't figured out how they fit together. There is some righteous way that we can pray against an enemy, and we see this in how David prays. Now, it's not said in this psalm who David is praying against. I'm sure during his lifetime he had more than one enemy. I can see how this would fit, this particular psalm, with King Saul and Doeg the Edomite and all the armies of Israel that came after David for no reason. He was innocent. He had done nothing but good for Saul. And yet, because some of the young women, after David had victory in battle, said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s, Saul was jealous of David and came chasing after him. Not because David had done anything wrong to Saul, but just because David had actually done what was right and good and favorable to Saul as his general when Saul was king, and yet he did it in a way that made Saul jealous. And then some wicked men, knowing that they could win favor by Doeg the Edomite, maybe the most famous of them, knowing that they could win favor with Saul the king by going against David unrighteously, win against him. And so I think if we were going to put this psalm with a particular event, it would fit with that, in my mind, best. But it's not; it doesn't say specifically that that's the event it goes with. So I'm not going to say dogmatically that that's it. It could apply to other events, possibly as well. Well, see, first what we have here, we have three prayers. One of them is a prayer for protection against a pursuer. The second prayer is prayer for perception and overturning of inequity and unrighteousness. And the third prayer is for a final judgment, one rejoiced in by God's people. And I'll go through each of these individually, but we see here David is praying in this psalm three separate prayers that all relate to his enemies. And the first is prayer for a protection against a pursuer. And we see this from the very start. David would have the Lord in verse 1. It says, plead my cause, O Lord, with those who strive against me. The first part of verse 1 is pleading. David is asking God to plead his cause like a lawyer would plead. You know, if you hire an attorney, you want them to defend you, don't you? And how do they defend you? By running a sword into somebody? No, by arguing that you are right, that either you have been wronged or that the people who are saying that you wrong them are wrong. The lawyer is on your side with arguments. And Daniel Creswell, a commentator on this, said plead, more literally litigate. That's actually what the kind of pleading that's talked about, litigation. So it's talking about what a lawyer would do. Oh, Lord, with them who litigate against me. These people were doing two things. They were attacking David, pursuing him physically, and they were also saying he had committed some kind of sin. They were not just a sin, but a crime.
And we all know, though, the tongue is the mightiest weapon there is.
Yes, and they were both speaking and they were chasing him. And you can see that when Saul was king and he was chasing after David, well, he had to make up certain things that David supposedly did. Doeg the Edomite followed him and basically blamed the priests for giving David the bread and the sword of Goliath and being on their side. And so there was all these different things. they accused David of treason to the king, which he was not. And there were other times like that too. So first, he's asking God for to be a lawyer, but then he needs him even more as his champion right now. You know, if somebody is chasing you, trying to kill you, what's your first concern? Did you get him in the law court, or that you'd be protected from this person physically?
Protection.
Yeah, the first concern is the protection. And so David needs both of these things, and he's asking the Lord for both of them in the first verse. But the next several verses is all about protection. And that's the first priority. Second priority is for David, for God to argue David's cause. And so you see right away after he mentions the two things, he goes into God will be his champion. Now he's asking specifically, and here's a good example of how to pray very specifically, because in these circumstances, David is not talking about spiritual things. I'm not saying you can't use this about spiritual things, but David was literally being chased. He literally had some people trying to kill him. And so he's praying specifically about those things. And look what he prays. First, as David's champion, he calls upon the Lord to arm himself. Notice verses 2 and 3. Take hold of shield and buckler and stand for my help. Also draw the spear and stop those who pursue me. Say to my soul, I am your salvation. The buckler and the shield. Now, God doesn't need literal shields and bucklers, but God can be a shield to us. Psalm 84, God has actually called a shield. He's called a sun and a shield. Here, he's saying, take hold of shield and buckler. This is why, because David needs protection. And even the spear part, also draw out the spear and stop those who pursue me. Now, in those days, you know, there were different weapons. What were some of the weapons that we know of that were used in biblical times? Does anybody know? The spear is definitely one. What other weapons? What's that?
They used rocks also as weapons.
Yep, David used the slingshot, and he used rocks as weapons. They weren't the most, you know, that wasn't. You know why Israel used weapons against the Philistines like rocks and slingshots? The Philistines had first taken control of Israel and outlawed Israel from making swords. And so Israel was not allowed to make swords under the Philistines. And secondly, that was first. The second thing is they hadn't developed the technology to make a metal sword like the Philistines had at the time. And so when David takes a slingshot against Goliath, it's not that he never had a sword, because actually Saul was willing to give him the armor and his weapons, and yet he wasn't used to using it because they weren't allowed to use them. And it's kind of like you know, gun control. They had sword control at the time. And it worked for one nation over another nation, because one nation had all the swords and another did not. Well, David developed the skill with the slingshot because he used it to protect his sheep. And he went against them and defeated Goliath, and then the Israelites would have probably, many of them probably developed skills with slingshots and things, and they defeated them. And they, when they defeat them, what do they get? They get their swords. You know, when they've knocked them down, they would take their swords. But here, and they had used spears, and the spear was used in a certain way in that area. Israel is a very mountainous area, and if you're climbing up a mountain or running on a mountain, sometimes, and you may even see this in you know, movies or if you've driven in a mountainous place before. Has anybody here ever driven on a mountain? Yes, I have. I've been out in Colorado and I've driven on a mountain. Was it scary at all?
At first I was scared to drive on any of the mountains.
Uh-huh.
But I got myself trapped into it. And after that, I didn't mind it.
Uh-huh. At first it was scary. What specifically is scary about driving on a mountain?
Because there's all these curves that are so sharp.
Yeah, and what if you went off the edge of the curve? Yeah, I remember, see, I was raised in Illinois, which is all flat, and Florida's pretty flat too, but I spent some time in Colorado, and I did have to drive up on those mountains a couple times, and I remember, you know, if you're driving on the side of the road that's next to the edge of the mountain, there's no way you can go a little further that way. You're going to go down. And it was scary. I thought it was scary. Well, they have mountains in Israel, too, and at that time they didn't have cars, but there would be some paths along the mountain that were so narrow that only one person could come in at a time. And armies typically had their biggest soldier have a very long spear. It might be 10, 12 feet long. And he could hold this spear. And if he held this spear and the enemy was coming, well, they can only come signal file. So if they're coming against this big guy with a spear, he could hold 100 men back because he's big and strong and he's got this sharp spear poking at them, and they can't go around him. They can't pass. And, you know, at that time they didn't have guns. They had arrows and things like that, but he's holding them back like that. And that's what David is saying here. David, in this psalm, is presenting himself as being chased by his enemies. And so now he's up in the mountain. And it's interesting because literally was up in the mountain when Saul was chasing him. And so this very well could be the case. Not that God was there holding the spear, but some of David's mighty men could have been holding that spear, and David is running past to safety while the people are chasing him, but that big man, and here it's God spiritually protecting David in this circumstance with that long spear. That's what he's asking for. Now, it doesn't mean that David would literally have God holding a spear, but it does mean God would work to David's protection. You know, David was never found by Saul on that mountain. And there was one time where Saul was about to find him. And what happened? Does anybody remember this time? Where Saul was closing in on David and would have found him. What happened that made him not find him? Well, somebody communicated to Saul that the Philistines were attacking Israel while he was chasing David, and so he had to take the army and go fight the Philistines. But it happened right at that time when he was chasing David, and so God protected him by allowing that to happen. Notice he prays specifically, practically throwing through God's power and prayer, everything but the kitchen sink and his pursuers as they chase him. You know, he's got the shield and the buckler and the spear, and look at what else. A, let those be put to shame and brought to dishonor who seek my life. So that's the general effect he wants on these people. Shame and dishonor. If they're chasing him like Saul was, for no reason other than he's jealous of him, and here's David who's actually fought for Saul, he should be ashamed of that. And there was at least sometimes, you know, David didn't kill Saul when he had opportunity to kill him. And he could prove that to Saul. And David is up on a mount, or showing Saul that he has his part of his garment, and he has his sword. I can't remember what it was. He is holding it, and Saul, for a momentary time, is saying, "You are right. I was wrong. I'm sorry." And later he changes his mind about being sorry, and he starts chasing David again. But for a short time, he's ashamed of what he's been doing. He knew David was right. And so that shame and dishonor were there. All of his soldiers who were following Saul, who were commanded to do so in chasing David, would have heard that. Shame and dishonor. They pursue a righteous man, and they pursue somebody for no good reason. And we'll see more of that later in this psalm. He prays that they would be turned back and brought to confusion. Turned back meaning they would not be able to keep pursuing him, and brought to confusion. You know, what's confusion? Have you ever felt confused?
Yeah. Yes. I really don't know what the answer is to what confused about.
What's a circumstance that either you've been in or you know that would be confusing even if you haven't been in it?
Oh, algebra.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are confused by math.
I know.
It's either algebra, and if you get past algebra, there's trigonometry, and if you get past that, there's calculus. And somewhere along the line, you're probably going to be confused if you keep trying to do it. If there's one level, there's another. If one level you're not confused with, you could go up another level and be confused by that. It's the way math is.
I've taught all of it.
You did a calculus too?
Yeah.
Did you confuse some of your students, or were some of them confused at one point or another, or were they? Did they all learn it?
Oh. I wasn't that good a teacher. I mean, I was pretty good, but yeah, there were some.
There were some that cried, "I can't understand this." Oh, yes. That's confused. That's one type of confusion. I think you could be confused chasing somebody too. You run to a path, and it looks like a place you've been before. You're in the woods. That's where they. You know, this is wooded mountain, and. Or you go to a path that goes two different ways and you don't know which way. And if I imagine David was tricky and he has got God on his side, confuse them. They could be confused as they go chasing after him. Turn back.
What's that? Also the time when with Gideon, when God confused all of his enemies and they started killing each other.
Yes.
So even God can put that confusion.
And see, David would have been able to read about that part in the scripture.
Right.
He would have had that. And how did God confuse him? Remember that particular time?
I don't remember exactly what it means.
Yeah, they had pottery and they broke it. And they all yelled the sword of the Lord in Gideon. Oh, and right, I think they played the trumpets. Right. And it was the middle of the night, so all these guys were sleeping, and they started hearing all this racket. How many men did Gideon have? 300. How many were on the other side? Well, it says more than the sand of the seashore. They had a huge numbers, millions of people maybe, against 300. Well, the only way 300 can win is if the other army is confused. And God brought that confusion. They heard all this noise. It was the middle of the night, and they were killing each other because they woke up and they think they're being attacked. And it's dark, and they don't see each other, and they kill each other. So that's, you know, I remember when I presented that in this group with y'all at River Commons. And there was a man here, and I can't think of his name right now, but he doesn't come very often.
No, not Al.
It's not somebody that has been here recently. But he basically was trying to, he says, "I just don't believe that. That couldn't happen. People can't be that confused." And he didn't want to believe that part about Gideon. But God can bring confusion. And we see a lot of that happening even today, where people who have rebelled against God are very confused about a lot of things in a different way. He prays, let them be like chaff before the wind. Do you all remember, you know, from Psalm 1, what is chaff?
It's the, when they shake the wheat to get rid of the chaff. That's
yeah, it's the outer kernel of the outer part of the wheat. And what is chaff good for? Do you remember?
Not much.
Nothing. It's worthless. So, and what they do, they had these like little sheds, but you know, they'd have two walls, not four walls, on these sheds, and the grain would be in these, and the wind, it would be set so the wind would blow through, you know, where there's missing walls. And so they'd come in there with a shovel in the middle of this little place that has two walls missing, and they'd throw the wheat or the grain up in the air, and the wind would blow through, and the good part, the food part, would fall down because it's too heavy to be affected by the wind. But the chaff would be blown by the wind. And so he prays that his enemies, he says, let them be like chaff before the wind. Let them be blown away, which basically means defeated. Can chaff fight anything? Can chaff fight anything at all? It's not even strong. You know, it gets blown by the wind. It would be very flammable with fire. It could be easily burned because it's dry, it's lifeless. And then he says, and so chaff is one of the weakest things. It's not like steel. It's not even like a piece of grain that would have some weight to it. It's light. And so chaff is one of the, you know, chaff is light, it's lifeless, and it's easily blown away. And then the opposite of that, he prays, and let the angel of the Lord chase them. Well, the angel of the Lord, when we see the word the angel of the Lord, it could be referring to Jesus, his pre-incarnate state. Either that or it's a very, very strong angel, a very powerful angel. And in Isaiah 37, 36, it talks about the angel of the Lord. Then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when the people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses all dead. So one angel was able to kill 185,000 soldiers. And so when he's saying, let them be like chaff, and let the angel of the Lord chase them, it's not an even fight. He's saying, Lord, help me in this circumstance, and I want your full help. And if it's talking about the angel of the Lord, who is Jesus, who is God, it's even more powerful against them. As it says in Romans 8:31, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? And David did have God for him. That's why he was able to defeat the Goliath. That's why he always won against the Philistines. If you read about his mighty men, they always were winning victories, sometimes even when they were greatly outnumbered, or they were defeating Goliath's children who were also giants. We see that. And so God worked and was powerful on David's behalf. As they chase him, he prays. Several things here all at once under D. Let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of the Lord pursue them. For without cause they have hidden their net for me in a pit, which they have dug without cause for my life. Let destruction come upon him unexpectedly, and let his net that he has hidden catch himself into that very destruction. Let him fall. Well, he prays that they would be in darkness. And darkness means what? You can't see. And sometimes there's a moral and a spiritual darkness. Sometimes there's a darkness, even if you're, there's all sorts of darknesses, aren't there? There's a darkness that's like confusion. If you're blind, you could be in darkness even when it's light. He prays, though, that they would, their way would be dark. And what other word does he use? Slippery. Slippery meaning they will fall. And maybe if their way is slippery, they'll keep falling. Have you ever seen somebody, or maybe it happened to yourself? Maybe it's partly why you're here in Florida. You don't want to go on that ice because you'd slip and fall and slip and fall and slip and fall. I've slipped on the ice a few times. I'm glad I'm here in Florida. It's a lot easier to walk around here.
Mm-hmm.
But slippery places, he prays. And so if they're chasing him, and then he says, let the angel of the Lord chase after them. And so the angel of the Lord is coming after them. And then he prays that, he says, let destruction come upon them unexpectedly, and let the net that he has hidden catch himself. And we see an example of that, not so much with David, but later with Haman. Do you remember the story of Haman? And with Esther and Mordecai. Haman was second in command in the Medo-Persian Empire. And Esther married the king. But Haman didn't know that Esther was a Jew. Well, Haman was bothered. Haman was not a Jew, but there was a Jewish man, Mordecai, who wouldn't bow down to Haman. Now, anybody have an idea why he wouldn't bow to Haman?
Because it may be an act of worship.
Yes.
And he was Jewish.
And he didn't feel he should worship or bow down to another man. And so he did not bow to Haman. Well, Haman was very offended by this. And so much offended that he not only wanted to condemn Mordecai, who would not bow, but he wanted to kill all the Jews. And he put it into law. He snuck a law by the king. The king didn't realize, because he said, Haman wrote the law something like this. He said, there's a certain people that they're nothing but troublemakers. We don't see any reason that we should have them in our kingdom. Please write this law that lets on a certain day we will get rid of them. And so he put that law, and the king signed it, not knowing he was talking about the Jews. And not knowing, the king didn't even know that his wife Esther was a Jew. And so I have two verses here. The first one is after Mordecai bothered him some more. Haman goes home because he wouldn't bow to him. Haman goes home and he brags to his wife and his friend, oh, the king loves me and everything's going well and I had such a good day today, except when I came out, Mordecai would not bow to me and it ruined all my good day. And I'm in such a bad mood because he wouldn't bow to me. So everything was going great for Haman. But one man in the kingdom wouldn't bow to him, and that ruined everything. It was like the worst thing he could imagine. I'm paraphrasing here, but he was upset. And so his wife, it says, then his wife Zeresh, her name was Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. You know how long a cubit is? It's from here to here on a man's hand, so it's different lengths depending on who it is.
18 inches.
Yeah, it's this length here. And 50 of those high. It's a very tall gallows. You wouldn't need it that high to hang somebody, but that's what they wanted to do. Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet, and the thing pleased Haman. And the king pleased Haman, so he had a gallows made. Well, that was Esther 5:14. There's something in between there. And I'll tell you a little bit about the in-between. In between, after his wife said this, and he liked that idea of building the gallows, he's going to go to the king to request this. Well, in the meantime, the king has had trouble sleeping. And so what do you do when you have trouble sleeping? Anybody have an idea? What's that?
Roll and toss.
What else? Do you have any other things you might do other than that? I do what the king did sometimes. He started reading. And this king, he had servants, so he could ask somebody to bring him something to read. And he asked for the records of the kingdom. So I'm thinking he probably asked for the records because there would have been a lot of things that would be written down that might be boring. And he said, this is a way I can fall asleep. I'll read something boring. Well, he starts reading the records, and he comes across in the record how Mordecai, this man Mordecai, which he might not have even known before this, had reported to certain people that there was a plot to kill the king. And he reported this plot, and the plot was uncovered by the king's men. And so Mordecai, in an indirect way, had saved the king's life. And so the king has been reading this, and now it's early morning, and he's been reading about Mordecai saving his life. And at the same time, according to the order from his wife Zeresh, or the suggestion, Haman is coming in. The day before, the king loved him, and so he's been doing well with the king. And he's about to request that Mordecai be hung on the gallows. But the king has just read that Mordecai saved him. And so the king says, without mentioning Mordecai, to Haman, he yells out to Haman as Haman is coming in, before Haman had a chance to say anything, what should be done for the man that the king desires to honor? He's asking a question, not knowing what Haman is thinking. And Haman doesn't know what the king is thinking either. And he says, who would the king desire to honor rather than me? And so he thinks it's himself. He's all stuck up. And so he says, well, dress this man in the king's clothes and put him on the king's best horse and have one of the king's noblemen take him around town and say, this is what is done for the man the king desires to honor. And Haman was thinking this was for him, but the king says, okay, go and do this for Mordecai. And so Haman has to carry Mordecai around, leading him around on this horse, yelling, this is the thing the king desires to do for the one he wants to honor. And he knows at this point he's in trouble. he's figured that he's not going to be able to kill Mordecai. And so he goes and he tells his wife these things. And his wife basically agrees, you're a dead duck. And but there's still a chance because he hasn't met with Esther yet. He's had this meal with the king, with the queen. The queen has asked for a meal with the king and with Haman. And they have this meal, and at the meal, Esther reveals that she's a Jew and that Haman has this plan to kill all the Jews. And so what happens? Well, verse 7:10 is part of that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. And so Haman is hung on the very gallows that he had actually had built for Mordecai. Okay, David promises personal praise to God for his protection. Verses 9 and 10, "And my soul shall be joyful in the Lord. It shall rejoice in his salvation. All my bones shall say, Lord, who is like you, delivering the poor from him who is too strong for him. Yes, the poor and the needy from him who plunders him." Notice here, you know, David's soul and his bones will praise God for delivering. And, you know, God saves our souls, doesn't he? And in David's case, he's saying, my bones are going to praise you because you saved my bones too. These men would have broken my bones. So his bones praise God. And that's the first part. I'll go quickly through the other two parts, hopefully. The first part, you know, he's praying against his pursuers. And you see all these different details he prays. And then he says, I'll praise you. And he's talking about a personal praise. Well, second is prayer for perception and overturning of inequity and unrighteousness. David asked the Lord, plead my cause. This, I said, was a call. You know, I remember I mentioned the call for the lawyer in verse 1. It is present and most pressing need was protection. And that's what was in the first part of the psalm. This second part, it starts in verse 11. Fierce witnesses rise up. They ask me things I do not know. So these men are coming, witnesses against David, asking him questions that he has no clue about. And then David's action towards his enemies are prerequisite to imprecatory prayer. You know, I already mentioned from Matthew 5:44, Jesus said, but I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you. And this sometimes is different. I mentioned Romans 12:18-21, because there it also says, vengeance is mine. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. And he says, for in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. And how do you heap coals of fire on somebody's head? By being nice to them? Well, he says it, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And he says, do not overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And when somebody is evil towards us, and we're kind to them, and in spite of that kindness, they still come at us with all the evil they can get. If we leave it to the Lord, he will bring coals of fire on their head. They will end up in hell, is what he's saying. And why? Because they deserve it. They've been treated kindly. Everybody's been good to them. And so, you know, when we're told to love our enemies, it's not necessarily meaning that God is going to love them forever because we love them. No, if we love them and they continue after us, God will put them in hell, is what it's saying. And so here's what we see. David writes in Psalm 35, they reward me evil for good. He was good to them. They were evil to him. To the sorrow of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. Remember sackcloth? What was sackcloth? Would you like to wear sackcloth? No, it was the most uncomfortable thing you could put on. And the Jews put it on when they were miserable for any reason. And not just the Jews, but if you remember, the Ninevites clothed themselves in sackcloth and fasting. It's what you did when you wanted to cry and you were crying out for, you know, you were thinking you were going to be killed, or your best friend was going to be killed, or you know, your child was dying. You'd put on sackcloth and pray in those desperate circumstances. And so when these people were sick, David put on sackcloth and he was crying for them. And it says that. It says, I humbled myself with fasting, meaning he stopped eating, and my prayer would return to my own heart. I paced about as though he were my friend or brother. And so when these people who were against David were sick, he prayed for them and paced back and forth. I bowed down heavily as one mourns for his mother, but in my adversity they rejoiced. So when David had trouble, they were happy and they were laughing. When they had trouble, he cried and prayed for them. When he had trouble, they rejoiced and gathered together. And attackers gathered against me, and I did not know it. They tore at me and did not cease. With ungodly mockers at feast, they gnashed at me with their teeth. Lord, how long will you look on? Rescue me from their destruction, my precious life from the lions. And he calls them lions because they're beasts. You know, a lion, no matter how much you might pet it and treat it kindly, eventually it might eat you. And that's what these people were like. They were like wild beasts. And here, verse 18, again, you know, he prays, and then at the end of the prayer, he gives thanks to God again. It says, I will give thanks in the great assembly. I will praise you among many people. Now, the first prayer was a personal prayer. This prayer is a public prayer. He prays, you know, and that's because he wants God to back him publicly, and he's going to pray publicly about it. And then the last part, prayer for a final judgment, one rejoiced in by God's people. David would have certain mouths and actions finally stopped. He says, let them not rejoice over me who are wrongfully my enemies. Don't let them win is basically what he's saying. Nor let them wink with the eye who hate me without a cause. For they do not speak peace, but they devise deceitful matters against the quiet ones in the land. The quiet ones are the people who are minding their own business. They're not causing any trouble. But there are certain people that are plotting against them to destroy them, including David. And so he says, but they devise deceitful matters against the quiet ones in the land. They also open their mouth wide against me. You know, they're always ready to speak against David. And, you know, when I said this almost sounds like, you know, Doeg the Edomite, you know, he was willing to talk and say false things against David to Saul. Or it could have been, if it were after he was king, it could have been people speaking that way. And said, aha, our eyes have seen it. When it says that, it's very interesting. Because they're claiming they saw something that David did wrong. Aha, our eyes have seen it. And like they're eyewitnesses. They're claiming to be eyewitnesses of this horrible thing. Aha, we caught you. You know, that's the way they are. And then it says, this you have seen, O Lord. Do not keep silent. You know, the Lord knows. Other people might not know. But I could say, aha, I saw you, Craig. And Craig might not have done anything wrong. And I didn't really see him. If I'm lying, but everybody else is sitting around, what do you think? If I said, oh, I caught you, aha, you think he must have done something very bad when you're screaming that way about what he did. Oh, I saw you. And that's what they were doing. They were acting like they saw David. And maybe they even thought they did. Because if you hate somebody enough, if you're against them enough, you can see them doing something wrong even when they're not. And that's what they're saying here. This you have seen, O Lord. Stir up yourself, awake to my vindication, to my cause. My God and my Lord, vindicate me, O Lord my God, according to your righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. Let them not say in their hearts, ah, so we would have it. Let them not say, we have swallowed him up. Let them be ashamed and brought to mutual confusion who rejoice in my hurt. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor who exalt themselves against me. And so these are people who are against David, and their eyes have seen it, and they all join in this. It's interesting. John Tripp writes, eyes for eyes, unless we would say that all the wicked are so conjoined that they may seem to have one eye, heart, and head. Notice it's a whole group. You know, it's not just one person. In the Old Testament, and this is true, I think, even here, but definitely in the Old Testament, according to law, there had to be two or three witnesses of any crime. One person could not accuse a person of a crime. Well, these people, they all saw David do something wrong, even though in reality none of them saw it. But they're going to say they did. They've all agreed. They all, you know, it's interesting. The psalm puts it, there's one eye that sees, and it really doesn't see at all, but they all have that same one eye. Because they all have that same, you know, it's kind of like a mob. And, you know,
it happened to Jesus.
Yeah.
All these false witnesses
come against him. And as soon as they say everybody, one thing, they all know it to be true, don't they? Even though it's not true.
Right.
You know, so here's the lesson from that. Beware of joining mob vision. There's a certain mob vision. It sees things that's not there. And mob action. It's ready immediately to act. They want to kill David. They'd already been chasing him. Not only against David, but against others. Verse 20, the quiet ones. The mob is always, you know, it's always the quiet ones. In our society, it's the Christians who are always wrong. You know, we don't do anything to anybody. But we're the haters. We're the terrible people. And we see that. That's what happens with the unrighteous. Yet he would have others speak freely, even shout. Verse 27, David says, let them shout for joy and be glad who favor my righteous cause, and let them say continually, let the Lord be magnified who has pleasure in the prosperity of his servant. And so he's saying there are certain people, they've kind of taken sides. You know, there are people on David's side and there are people who are in the mob against him. And the Lord is saying, you know, silence these people, these horrible people who are yelling against me. But let these people speak, the ones that know I'm right, the ones that praise you, Lord. And that verse kind of tells what it's all about. There were people, godly people, who were on David's side, and there were ungodly that were against him. And then the last part, on the last back of that last page, with this David promises perpetual praise, and he says, my tongue shall speak of your righteousness and your praise all the day long. And I've taken all the time long here, but there we see, you know, there was the personal praise when he was saved from his enemies. There was the public praise when he'd be vindicated, you know, when he was shown to be right in this circumstance, God was going to do that. And then there's the perpetual praise when David, not only David, but these others, all the ones against him, would be finally silenced, his enemies. And those people who had been on his side, who were godly people, they would have a voice. They had been quiet ones, but they would have a voice. And he doesn't say they'd be praising David, but they'd be praising the Lord. And he says, my praise will be continual. It'll be perpetual. I won't stop praising you, is basically what he's saying. So that's Psalm 35. Okay, well, let's pray. Father, we thank you for your goodness to us. We thank you for your